The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 361, The Swearing Elders, a panel featuring Sterling M. McMurrin and William Mulder.
Reminder that if you're a supporter of Sunstone Symposium being broadcast, let KCPW know. Their numbers are 649-4009 in Park City and 359-5279. That's 359-KCPW in Salt Lake City. This hour's broadcast will be a meeting of two of the original group that had many more members, called the Swearing Elders. And the members of today's panel are Sterling McMurrin, a perennial Sunstone favorite, and William Mulder, who is a professor of English at the University of Utah. We'll go now to our chair of the session, who is Teresa Whiting.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this session of the symposium. I'm supposed to remind you that you can't get in without a ticket, but since you're all in here, I assume you either had a ticket or found a way. In the spring of 1949, the first meeting of a group known as the Mormon Seminar, and informally known as the Swearing Elders, was held at the old University of Utah Library. There were 10 to 12 people in attendance, including Sterling McMurrin, William Mulder, Waldemar P. Reed, Obert C. Tanner, Herb Larson, Lowell Bennion, T. Edgar Lyon, and Don Orton. Between 1949 and 1955, the Swearing Elders met to listen to speakers and discuss various topics of interest to Mormon scholars. The group set the stage for the development of Mormon intelligentsia and attracted the attention of church hierarchy. In the fall of 1993, at the conclusion of the disciplinary councils for the September 6, Peggy Fletcher Stack began her news story on the events with this anecdote. In the summer of 1954, Salt Lake educator and self-proclaimed heretic Sterling M. McMurrin was told by his LDS leaders that he might be excommunicated. Word quickly reached then-church president McKay. The two met at the University of Utah in the Union Building. "If they put you on trial for excommunication, I will be the first witness in your behalf," the president assured the academic. The trial was never held. Today, we're very fortunate to have both Sterling McMurrin and William Mulder with us. They both hold the distinguished title of Swearing Elder Emeritus. In addition, Dr. McMurrin is the E.E. Erickson Distinguished Professor of Philosophy Emeritus from the University of Utah. He's the author, among other things, of this book entitled The Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, published by the University of Utah Press, and an interesting article in this March 1993 issue of Sunstone called Some Distinguishing Characteristics of Mormon Philosophy. William Mulder is an emeritus professor of English at the University of Utah. He is the author of Homeward to Zion, The Mormon Migration from Scandinavia, and the co-editor of Among the Mormons, Accounts by Contemporary Observers. And after this session, for those of you who would like to read more about the Swearing Elders, this issue of Sunstone features the cover story on the Swearing of Elders. The Swearing Elders. And without any further gaffes, I will turn the time over to Sterling McMurrin.
I joined the University of Utah faculty in the fall of 1948, and sometime around Christmas, I think it was, a young man whom I had known in California, Herbert Larson, who was a doctoral candidate in sociology, called on me and told me that there were a number of young in the university who would like to get together and have me teach them a course on Mormon theology. And I said, "Now, Herb, you're big boys now, and you should have known everything there is to know about Mormon theology when you were in high school." But he was quite persistent. And I said, "Now, if you can't get your minds off of Mormonism long enough to go to school, what you better do is just get together once in a while and talk about it." and occasionally invite in someone who may be writing a book or has done a dissertation or something of that kind on a Mormon theme. Well, he said, we'll see. Later on, in the early part of the next year, he came to see me again, and he said, we have decided that we will do that, what you suggested, provided you can get William Mulder, who was a rising star then in the Department of English, and Obert Tanner and Waldemar Reed, who were in the philosophy department, provided you can get them to join us and for me to join them. Well, we finally agreed to join them. And one of the main figures for the balance of that year who met with us was the distinguished Mormon rural sociologist Lowry Nelson of the University of Minnesota, who was visiting professor at the University of Utah at that time. And it was Professor Nelson who referred to this group as the Elders. He is the one that actually named the outfit. Now, we really didn't do any swearing, did we, Bill? I don't recall. You're a hell or damn once in a while. We don't. You understand, our language was limited to the regular church authorized swear words. Hell, damn, son of a bitch, and bastard. We didn't go beyond that. This is a very well-behaved group, a very pious group, as a matter of fact. I do remember one significant outburst of swearing, and you may recall, Bill, it was at the very first session by Obert Tanner. Tanner and I were sitting together just around a big table, they were discussing what subject we should have for the year. Everybody has to have a subject in the church. And somebody said, I think we should study the Book of Mormon. And Obert, in a very rough voice, said, now listen, if you think we're going to come here and read the Book of Mormon and study it, you're just in the wrong place. And some other guy said, well, some of us feel that we should keep up to date on our Book of Mormon theology. And Obert slammed his fist on the table and stood up and said, my hell, I'm in the wrong place. You recall that, Bill, and he stomped out of the room. Well, that was a rather bad beginning. This is the very first part of the first session. And Waldemar Reed said to me, you better go and bring him back if you can. I got hold of him down the hall and persuaded him to come back. That's the only real honest-to-goodness swearing, I think, that was engaged in, except for those authorized terms. Well, the interesting thing is that we didn't get very far, actually. By the end of the school year, Herb Larson, who was our guru and organized the thing and took charge, got his Ph.D., and he went down to the college in Price to teach. And so that was the end of it. At least we thought it was the end of it, until Lowell Binion and T. Edgar Lyon, who were the faculty of the LDS Institute, as most of you would know, got hold of Bill Mulder and me and said, look, you fellows have got to do something to keep that thing going. Now, it's the only chance we have to really talk seriously about things that we would like to do. We can't do it on this side of the street, and we can't handle it, but you'll just have to keep it going. And after some persuasion, Bill and I agreed to do what we could. And our idea was to invite people in who had done or were doing scholarly work in the Mormon field or in fields closely related to it, and have various sessions with them. Now, the interesting thing is that the real backbone of the group, and you understand it was entirely informal, were leading professors from the BYU. They constituted at least half of those who attended. And when I say leading professors, I mean the outstanding people at the BYU who had some great... This was a man's affair, you understand. We didn't admit women in those days. I mean, today things have really changed. I was about to say things have really gone downhill, but I thought... Anyway, people like P.A. Christensen, who was a giant in the faculty of the BYU, George Hansen, Brigham Madsen, and Leonard Rice, John C. Swenson, and Charlie Redd, who wasn't in the BYU, but was about as important in himself as the BYU was as an institution, a very considerable number of those outstanding people, Heber C. Snell from Logan, who was the church's leading Bible scholar, and Jennings Olson, from Weber College. Jennings was the intellectual leader of Weber College, a person of really remarkable talents. And a number of people from the University of Utah. Bill did the work. He and I would come get together and consult on who to get. We always had sometimes someone from the group itself. Like Polson, head of psychology at the BYU. We had the main figures from the BYU. If that hadn't been the case, the thing wouldn't have survived except for Lowell Bennion and T. Edgar Lyon, and a year later, George T. Boyd, when he joined the Institute faculty. That was the best combination of a faculty for the teaching of religion, which the church had at that time, and as a matter of fact, may be better than anything that the church has at the present time. Those three men whom I have mentioned. Well, as a matter of fact, we had a good time. We moved to the basement of the old Union building where there was a cafeteria. They let us have a sizable room, and then we could get Cokes. The people at the BYU couldn't buy Cokes down there. I think that's one reason they came up. So we could buy Cokes and milkshakes and so on. I don't think anybody ever... I was brave enough to tackle coffee, but everything was informal. Bill handled the work by sending out the invitations, and my wife has told me that it wasn't Bill at all, that it was his wife who did the work, and she is here at the present time. Well, now that's about all I need to say for the moment. Bill is going to give you the substance of some of our meetings, and then I want to do a little wrap-up because, as the chairman indicated, this thing got known downtown, 47 East South Temple. And so there is a little follow-up on it, and I'll take care of that.
It's a rare privilege to ride into Sunstone on Sterling McMurrin's coattails, I should say shirttails. Our association goes back half a century to the time we met in Tucson, Arizona, when Sterling was serving as director of the LDS Institute of Religion there, adjacent to the campus of the University of Arizona, where I was being indoctrinated as an ensign in the U.S. Naval Reserve. It was a fleeting encounter. As a 90-day wonder, I was sent to the Naval Communications School at Harvard and assigned to a communications unit headed for Okinawa. What a pleasure it was to encounter this handsome, polished, and articulate contemporary. He was my elder by only a year, at the University of Utah after the war, newly acquired for the philosophy faculty by an astute president, A. Ray Alpin, who proved to be a match for what was essentially a crisis on campus to accommodate the growth of these post-war years. As an instructor in English, completing a master's degree, I sat in on some of Sterling's courses in the history of philosophy, amazed, as was everyone else, at his ability to lecture without notes as he moved sentence after perfect sentence through the hour, elegant argument cheek by jowl with homely anecdote. On trips to meetings of the Utah Academy and the once flourishing Utah Conference on Higher Education, trips to Logan or Provo or Cedar City and St. George that allowed for endless conversation, we discovered a kindred skepticism in the spirit of Santayana's admonition that the chastity of the mind should not be yielded too easily nor to the first comer. That intellectual modus operandi, together with a Jewish professor's quotation that human nature is biological in its root and spiritual in its flower, has helped me mediate between naturalistic and transcendental explanations of the mysteries, enabling me, in a William Jamesian way, to carry on in a world of real losses and real gains. Through all these years since that first meeting with Sterling, he has been an example of intellectual integrity and moral courage, a stimulating and steadying presence. For that and much else, I thank him. And now, isn't it shameful that a couple of octogenarians should be called back from retirement to recount some midlife follies which have acquired a legendary aura? Well, they weren't follies at all, as I intend to demonstrate, but a serious effort on the part of a handful of Mormon academics to explore their heritage. The planners and promoters of Sunstone need to be reminded that there's a standard known as truth in advertising. What can we make of a description that calls these academic seekers a bunch of renegade Mormon professors who raised hell in the 50s? Sunstone's query, "What did the swearing elders swear about?" of course creates curiosity and leads to the extravagant venue of the Three Seasons Ballroom. So, it must be disappointing to tell you we were no cabal no Council of 50 or School of the Prophets, no Mormon Alliance. We had no agenda other than to promote free discussion of Mormon origins, beliefs, practices, and institutions. In short, Mormon history and culture. We were as placid as the 50s themselves, which are known as the Placid Decades. The excitement was internal, not programmatic, as we opened a few windows and felt the relief of ventilation. If minds were changed, the growth was as quiet as cells dividing. Remember, this was before Sunstone and Dialogue and BYU Studies. We called ourselves the Mormon Seminar, as Sterling has said. Certainly less colorful than the Swearing Elders, and actually, we planned a mimeographed publication to be called Mormon Studies or Mormon Monographs or Mormon Digest. We drafted a prospectus which read, partly in Sterling's hand, partly in mine, as follows. Mormon Monographs is intended to afford publication for research on various aspects of Mormonism, its history, thought, and culture, to encourage students to make their findings more widely and readily available. Mormon Monographs will appear at irregular intervals as materials are made available. Publication and distribution will be at cost. Authors reserve all rights to future use of their contributions. The monograph series intends, in fact, to serve as an intermediate purpose, providing tentative studies, an experimental form in which a critical audience may test ideas before they are finally committed to print. That's a good generation before the journals we have now. But it was all a dream. The editorial committee would include Sterling and me, Ione B. Daniels, Dean of Women at USU, Leonard Arrington at USAC, as it was then, Agricultural College, J. Golden Taylor at BYU, Gustav Larson at Cedar City, and Juanita Brooks at St. George. We used our Mormon seminar, a mailing list, and solicited a dollar to get things going. Our first issue, planned for January 1952, intended to feature a paper by Leonard Arrington called The Concept of Enterprise Among the Mormons in Early Utah, a manuscript I still have in my possession, my Mormon Studies file, along with Leonard's correspondence about it. For reasons I don't even remember, the project never got off the ground. Leonard, if you're here, and if you've ever given that paper a second thought, you now know where to find it. I'm going to add it, with all its editorial markings, to your papers and special collections at USU. And don't ask me what happened to the dollar. It probably went for postage. Well, in publication then, we were spectral forerunners of the professional outlets we enjoy today, and to which many of the original Swearing Elders have contributed. Sterling and I were the secretariat for the Mormon Seminar and its very irregular calendar. The basis of our mailing list was the very large group of educators along the Wasatch Front who, in 1949 and 50, had been invited to a series of meetings in Salt Lake City, Ogden, and Logan to consider the general problem of Mormon religious education as it relates to individual and community growth. On January 12, 1951, we addressed a dear friend letter saying that for over a year now, a number of university men and downtown compatriots have been meeting weekly and informally at the U of U in what, for want of a better name, may be called a Mormon seminar. Our procedure has been simple. Someone in the group, or as frequently a visiting fireman, is introduced a subject sufficiently to give it direction and momentum, and then turn it loose for free discussion. The talk has frequently attained high levels. Always it has been characterized by goodwill and good humor. We should like to continue these intellectual smorgasbords and the spirit in which they were originally conceived. We should like to continue the good talk on themes historical and political, social and economic, doctrinal and ecclesiastical, artistic and literary, as we explore Mormon life and thought. The letter announced that Stanley Ivins would talk about Juanita Brooks's new book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, at its first meeting, which was planned for Thursday, January 18th. At 3:30 in the Orchid Room Union Building on the U of U campus. We reminded our people that they would have to go through the coffee shop in the basement to reach the Orchid Room, and Sterling has already alluded to our sensitivity about that. Those who picked up Coca-Colas on the way became known as cold coffee Mormons. But we told the contingent from BYU we would refrain from directing them hereafter through the coffee shop to get them to the Orchid Room. Now, there's time only to list some of the speakers and topics that figured in our meetings during the next 3 or 4 years. Richard Paul of BYU speaking on the church and the federal government before 1900, the subject of his doctoral dissertation. Louis Zucker, distinguished Hebrew scholar at the U, who had encountered generations of young Mormons in his Bible literature classes, speaking on Old Testament ideas. Professor L.H. Kirkpatrick, head librarian at the U, speaking on Mormon libraries, the subject of his doctoral dissertation at the University of Chicago. A knowing Gentile, Kirk, we said, and his fund of information and anecdote, we can assure you an interesting excursion into Mormon intellectual history. Professor M.W. Polson of the BYU, student of early Mormon thought and collector of rare books on Mormonism, speaking on deciphering the coded parts of James T. Strang's diary. Leonard Arrington, speaking on some of his findings in Mormon economic history, having just published an article, Zion's Board of Trade, a Third United Order, in the Western Humanities Review. Professor Harold T. Christensen, chairman of the Department of Sociology at Purdue University, speaking on the isms of Mormonism. Professor Baker Brownell, outstanding authority on community life and resources and leading advocate of a small-town renaissance in America, meeting in an informal question-and-answer session. A professor of philosophy at Northwestern University, Dr. Brownell had been teaching at the U during the summer of 1951. Dr. Charles Dibble, associate professor of anthropology at the U of U, discussing the book Ancient America and the Book of Mormon by Milton R. Hunter and Thomas Ferguson. He didn't think much of it. Dibble, as you know, had achieved international recognition as a student of Aztec language and culture. Professor Hugh Nibley of BYU. Some of these names may surprise you. Professor Hugh Nibley of BYU, of course he was a youngster then, speaking on the Book of Mormon, an appearance subsequent to the publication of a series of articles in the Improvement Era on the subject. Stanley Ivins again, this time on the history and sociology of polygamy. Carl Carmer, noted poet, folklorist, historian, then currently at work on a book about the Mormons, eventually published as The Farm Boy and the Angel, a native of the burned-over district in upstate New York, speaking informally on some of his experiences and gathering his stories. The church didn't like the book they had commissioned, but on his own, finding an independent publisher, he did bring it out as The Farm Boy and the Angel. Dr. Louis Mensch of the Salt Lake Clinic, speaking on his experiences as a psychiatrist in a Mormon community. Bernard DeVoto, in town for a few days in May 1952, speaking in the East Lounge of the Old Union, a public meeting which absorbed the Mormon seminar. He spoke on aspects of the West in literature and history. Professor P.A. Parley Christensen of the BYU, whose dour Scandinavian philosophy had been described as an idealism stripped of any foolish expectations, leading a discussion ranging topics found in his collection of essays, All in a Teacher's Day. Jennings Olson, whom Sterling has already mentioned, and Professor Melvin A. Cook of the U of U discussing President Joseph Fielding Smith's recent volume, Man, His Origin and Destiny, to which Professor Cook had written an introduction. It was another evening session, declared, in fact, a ladies' night, this time in the little theater, the Union, the Old Union. And that event, which I hope Sterling will describe in great detail, took place on Saturday, November 13th, 1954, and proved to be our swan song, not that we were shut down. But I think circumstances led people in different directions, occupied with researching for dissertations and whatnot. Well, now that's enough sampling. In keeping with the adage that we don't have to eat a whole sheep to know what mutton's like. Now, where's the hell-raising in all this? None of us knew either the depth or fragility of another's faith, whether he paid tithing or not, believed in the Book of Mormon or not, attended church or not. We reveled in the atmosphere of academic freedom that prevailed at the U, which allowed us to meet in the library or the Union building and called for no accounting of our activities. On January 7th, 1952, I received a memo from G. Homer Durham, then a professor of political science at the U. He became academic vice president, eventually went to Arizona State as president. A memo from Homer, which read, "The campus mail has just brought in the January 4th, 1952 hectograph." Our messages were, you know, just mimeographed, hectographed, all those simple things before Xerox. "Has just brought in the hectograph signed by you and Sterling. The phrase Mormon seminar intrigues me. What is it? The crackpots, Aztecs, and others I know. But this sounds like a new one, and I'm curious. Good luck in your discussion of Dr. Geddes' cemeteries." That was one of the events early on, the sociologist Dr. Geddes at Utah State. "Sorry I have another meeting. The burial ground of Winnemucca and Peotia, Nevada are in bad shape, too. Well, Bernabello's New Mexico is simply fierce. Yours for raising the grass, if not the dead, G. Homer." Well, we raised little grass and less hell, and certainly raised no dead, except metaphorically. We stirred some ashes and blew some coals back into life, intellectually speaking. It was a heady time for me, immersed as I was in research that would lead to a Harvard dissertation on the Mormon migration from Scandinavia, as our program chair has mentioned, which was published in 1957 as Homer Design by the University of Minnesota Press, and the anthology with A. Russell Mortensen, we called Among the Mormons, Historical Accounts by Contemporary Observers, published by Knopf 1952, reprinted in paperback as a Bison book by the University of Nebraska Press. And now, if you'll pardon the commercial, brought back as a full-size paperback by Sam Weller under his Western Epics imprint. Kurt Bench, whether he has any copies. Now, works like that, I like to think, are the fruit of the kind of stimulation I got from the gatherings with my peers and betters in the Mormon seminar. Santayana's dictum and Sterling's example still guide me, but I'm comfortable with what we may call the problem of the Mormon intellectual, the title of a very brief essay I published many years ago in Dialogue, and here's a paragraph or two because I want to get back to Sterling. A continuing problem of the Mormon intellectual is to remain Mormon and intellectual. His is the problem of religious intellectuals generally, to dare to follow where the mind leads, to prevent the indecision that comes when intellectuals are persuaded in one direction but drawn emotionally in another. If one is robust, he may, like William James, will to believe, and find pragmatic reasons for the utility of faith, even when the premises are uncomfortable. The Mormon intellectual, like intellectuals everywhere, wants to know the truth and shares their faith that the mind can lead the way to it. But the mind is only a tiny light in the great surrounding dark of the universe. Sometimes the seeker has to grope his way by other sensibilities and senses other than sight to move to an elevation where the little light he does have throws a further illumination. Because he believes that faith is as much a dimension of total experience as is reason, the Mormon intellectual may tolerate premises, doctrines, and practices in his church which, rationally examined, seem archaic, untenable, even at times repugnant. On the chance, these contain values he cannot now appreciate but someday will. Or on the chance that he himself may be instrumental in changing them. When faith itself becomes unreasonable, however, putting too great a strain on his credulity, he has to make the hard choice of silence or separation. Thank you.
Listen to Bill Mulder in his speech, or as today reading something that he wrote many years ago. I feel very much because of the elegance of his language and expressiveness. I feel very much like the Indian who was out on one of these high bluffs in southern Nevada back in the 50s. He had a fire and a blanket and was sending up smoke signals. And all of a sudden, one of those test atomic bombs went off. And he watched this great cloud rise into the air. And he said, "I wish I had said that." Well, that's the way I feel when I listen to Bill. Now, he mentioned, as I did earlier, the faithfulness of these BYU people coming up to this affair. They were the mainstay of it. And I must tell you two experiences in that connection. We used to take turns as chairman of these sessions. I happened to be chairman on this one, and I was told that there was somebody at the door who wanted to come in. And we closed the door, as you understand. And I went to the door, and here were two young men, both of them advanced graduate students at the BYU. And they told me that they had hitchhiked their way from Provo to Salt Lake and would simply like to join us for that occasion. I was just about to let them in when P.A. Christensen came over and stopped me. And he said, if any BYU students come in here, we'll have to leave. That was a pretty sorry observation on the intellectual status of the BYU. Now, Wilkinson discovered that we were holding these affairs in the afternoon, and P.A. Christensen told me that they would not be able to come any longer because in order to keep them from coming, President Wilkinson had put out an order that the faculty were to be in their offices until 5 o'clock. So they couldn't come anymore. And so all we did, Wilkinson should have known that we had pulled a fast one on him. We just moved the things to 7:30. And everything went well. Well, now, Bill mentioned our session. It was our last session because we were kind of worn down with this and decided to do something else. Our last session was a hassle involving Melvin Cook, who was the supporter of the anti-scientific material in that terrible book by Joseph Fielding Smith. What is it called? Destiny of Man? Was that the title of it? Man is Origin and Destiny. And Jennings Olson, who was professor of philosophy and anthropology at Weber. And Jennings was kind of anxious to take Cook on. And Cook was very agreeable. So we held a final session, even after we had sort of decided to drop the thing. And three general authorities came to the affair. Joseph Fielding Smith's son-in-law, Bruce McConkie, and President Hunter of the 70s, and I think the other one was Apostle Peterson, those three. And I just have to tell you one little story in connection with this. Well, I'll tell you two stories. The head of geology at the university, Professor Stokes, called me up, wanted to know if he could come. Well, he hadn't been associated with it. No reason why he shouldn't have been, but he hadn't. But he heard about this. He wanted to come and get in on it. And toward the end of the affair, when Melvin Cook, who was professor of metallurgy at the University of Utah, and one of the leading, if not the leading, authority. Nuclear explosions, non-nuclear explosions, possibly in the world. Whenever you hear some dynamite going off, that isn't dynamite. That's Cook stuff. And is a man of great achievement in and fame in that field. Well, Stokes said to him, well, Professor Cook, apparently you don't believe the position that is held by virtually all the scientists in the world today, that sedimentary rocks were laid down under water and under great pressure, and igneous rocks such and such, and metamorphic rocks came in. Apparently you don't believe that that's the way things happened. And Cook said, "Oh no, that'd take a long time." He just couldn't conceive of the idea that God would have enough time to create the world in anything more than about 6 days. He got pretty tired, though, and rested on the seventh, so maybe he didn't take much time. I think it was either James E. Talmage or Orson F. Whitney that wrote, "These people who insist on saying, 'Oh, it wasn't 6 days, a day with man, a day with God is 1,000 years from man,' it took 6,000 years." And he said, either Whitney or Talmage said, "That's like saying, if you can't dam the Mississippi River with a teaspoon, for heaven's sake, use a tablespoon." Well, Llewellyn McKay was present on that occasion, head of the language department at the university, and son of President David L. McKay. He gave a short statement on President McKay's position with respect to that book, that book by Joseph Fielding Smith was not to be used in any organization of the church for text purposes. But President Smith had a right to write and say whatever he wanted to, whatever he believed. But it was not to be used by the church for any kind of official activity. I think I'll tell... How much time do we have? Just a little bit, don't we? I think I'll just tell one more thing. Bruce McConkie, I hate to speak ill of the dead, but Bruce McConkie and I had crossed swords in the Wilshire Ward in Los Angeles at a stake affair, and he had been telling people to sit down because they couldn't answer his questions properly. And he would say, "You're wrong. Now you just sit down." And a couple of times these people didn't sit down. He said, "I told you to sit down." These were people, members of the, they were all Melchizedek priesthood. And so I had a kind of a hassle with him. And now, several years later, he, of course, was there defending his father-in-law's book right up to the hilt, doing a masterly job of it in a very, very firm language. And the janitor came to the door. It was getting late. And he said, "I've got to lock up the building. You people are going to have to leave." And I said, "Can we have 10 more minutes?" And he said, "Yes." We had about 10 people to talk. They had their hands up. Well, Bruce was up next. And he went on and on, and I did this, you know, like you do to him. And then finally I stood up. I was the chairman. I stood up. And he said, "Now, just a minute, Sterling." I said, "You just a minute, Bruce. Your time is up. You sit down." And I'm very pleased to say he sat down. Well, that's not the way I usually talk to general authorities. There's much more, of course, that Bill and I could tell you about the swearing elders. He makes it sound so nice. It's that elegant language of his. But we had a great time, and we didn't do the church a bit of damage. Now, I got an invitation. I wasn't called in, but I got an invitation from Harold B. Lee, who was an apostle, and Joseph Fielding Smith, who was then chairman or senior president of the 12, wondered if I would be willing. I had had sessions with them earlier and told them I'd be willing to meet again. Well, they wanted to meet again. So I met with them. The letter said, "We're interested in knowing about this group at the university that is criticizing us." Well, you know, I thought they meant criticizing the general authorities. Turned out they meant criticizing them, Joseph Fielding and Harold B. Lee. Well, we had a nice session, 2 hours. It was very pleasant. They were very, very congenial. At one point, I tried to give them the picture in nice terms, like Bill did, of what we were doing. And I remember they were interested in that review by Charlie Dibble of the Hunter Ferguson book on the Book of Mormon. It was Milton R. Hunter and Ferguson. Some of you would remember that book. And Joseph Fielding wanted to know, just what did Dibble say? I had pointed out to him that Dibble was a leading authority on the very materials that these men had used, the Sahagun materials. And, well, what did he think? What did he think? Well, I finally said, you know, he'd be happy to come in and talk to you. No, what did he say? Joseph Fielding said, well, I said he didn't think it was a very good book. Just the same thing that Bill said a few minutes ago. President Smith got up out of his chair and he walked over to his door and he came back and he said, we knew all along that those men weren't competent to write that book. You know, that pleased me no end to have Joseph Fielding Smith make a statement like that. Yeah, I asked them, I said, do you mean that you think we should not be meeting up there at the university the way we are? He said, oh no, we wouldn't for a moment say anything like that. He said, he used the term you educated men, and Apostle Lee used the term intellectuals, like Bill did. He said, no, you educated men have just as much right to meet and discuss Mormonism as anyone else. You have a perfect right to do that. Well, it sounded good, you know, coming from him. But Apostle Lee said, now, Sterling, you know what the church teaches. Now, at the end of every session, I shouldn't tell this, but you won't say anything. This is on the radio, isn't it? Jeez. I should have checked that out earlier. Apostle Lee said, but Sterling, you know what the church... Now, at the end of every session... Couldn't you just kind of sum up and say, but now let's remember, here is the position of the church on these matters. Well, I said, no, I couldn't do that. Well, why not? I said they wouldn't come again if I were to do that. Besides, I said, most of these men are old enough to be my father, and most of them are teachers at the BYU. They teach religion down there. I said, we can't behave like that. I mention that to you because, you see, here is a kind of a naivete about how you go about this sort of thing, as if we were holding some kind of Sunday school class. Well, Apostle Lee said, now, tell me, what kinds of things do you criticize President Smith for? I'd like to know, just why do you criticize him? And I said, well, now, President Smith, we were sitting at his desk, and I was across from him. Apostle Lee was at the end of the desk. I said, before I tell you, I can give you some good things, President Smith, and why you're criticized. But I said, before I tell you that, I want to tell you that the very people who criticize you have a great deal of genuine admiration for you. They admire you for your independence of mind and your honesty, that you're willing to you think and write what you think, regardless of what anybody else thinks about it. And I said, these very people who criticize you admire you for that honesty and courage. And, you know, he he smiled and he said, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Well, I began to tell him some of the things that he was criticized for. And before I really got anything good out, he kind of interrupted. I was starting on some things he had to say about the blacks, where he had said, in my opinion, the Negroes are getting... He said this at a commencement up at the Salt Lake Institute. I said, up at that commencement, and President Lee, Apostle Lee, happened to be there also. I said, at that commencement not long ago at the Salt Lake Institute, he said, were you there? I didn't see you there. I said, I certainly was there, and I just came because I knew you were going to be the speaker. That on that occasion you said that the Negroes, now what he actually said was they're getting just what they deserve. But he interrupted me, and he said, now I want to say what I believe about the status of the Negroes. They deserve every opportunity and every freedom and so on, that everyone else has. And he made an excellent statement. But it was quite the opposite of what he had had to say in the public statement. Well, all in all, it was a very pleasant airing of the what Bill is calling and what we called in those days the Mormon Seminar, and these men were very generous. They were very generous. It was a very decent hearing. I was involved with them on several occasions, those two, where I really bared my soul, and I didn't bare the souls of anybody else, but just my own. And I must say they were very generous. I was... delighted with the reception that I received from them. They've never called in. They simply asked me if I'd be willing sometime to meet with them. I presume that our time is pretty well gone.
Maybe one question.
Is there a question that anyone has? Bill will answer it. No questions. Please, Bob.
Sudden thought. Why was Joseph Fielding Smith not excommunicated for not keeping pure like the September 6th by publishing Man, His Origin and Destiny?
Well, I think I can give you an answer to that. In those days, there was a lot more freedom in the church than there is now. As I told you, President McKay's statement to that his son Llewellyn passed on to us on that occasion, that President Smith, he obviously held that his ideas were erroneous, but he said he has a perfect right to express those ideas and to publish them. So there you are. Things have changed in recent years. When I was growing up in high school, for instance, and college, there was a great deal more intellectual activity within the church itself. I don't mean more than you have here in the Sunstone Symposia, But leaving all of that out, there was far more real intellectual activity in the church and among the general authorities than there is today. When you had James E. Talmage and Orson F. Whitney and Brigham H. Roberts, people of that stature, and of course Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith were at each other's throats half the time. And they survived, and the church survived. And I think that's the answer. There was a kind of freedom in those days that we do not now have in the church. Now, when I say that, of course, here's a bunch of people in this hotel that are saying what they want to say, doing what they want to do, and nobody, I hope nobody's going to get hurt over it. We've had a few get hurt lately, but that may just be a passing phase. I'm of the opinion that the first presidency of the church would not tolerate that sort of thing right now that was going on about a year ago. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. We're adjourned.
And thanks for joining us for another Out of the Sunstone Symposium. We've just been hearing from Sterling McMurrin and Bill Mulder, both of whom were members of a group they called the Swearing Elders. In the late 40s and 50s, it was a group that preceded the modern Sunstone Symposium and Dialogue and all similar organizations and publications. Coming up in just about another 15 minutes, we'll have our concluding session of this year's symposium and of this year's symposium broadcast. This session will be comprised of an interview of Mormon historian D. Michael Quinn, who has written extensively on Mormon history and, in fact, recently completed a book, half of a two-volume series on the Mormon hierarchy and its development, establishment and development over the years, and who was excommunicated last year, or the year before, rather, for some of the things that he had written. And that will be starting at 4:45. It'll be the last broadcast of today's symposium coverage and of this year's symposium coverage as well. Sunstone thanks KCPW and Clay Anderson Audio for the help in bringing this symposium to you. We hope that you'll make it known to them that you appreciate this symposium being broadcast and the fact that we've had the broadcast in previous and hopefully future years. You can call KCPW in Park City at 649-4009, or if you're in Salt Lake, they can be reached at 359-KCPW. I'm Greg Campbell for the Sunstone Foundation, and until we come back to you again in about 15 minutes, we'll take you back to the KCPW studios.